Mom, Helen's daughter says. Mom, 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 don't. Helen leans into the mirror to pick a clot of mascara off her lashes. This mascara is too old. She'll buy a new tube today, now that she intends to be a regular working woman, someone who, rather than making a 30-foot commute from bedroom to study and working in her pajamas, actually dresses up and goes out of her house to be among other human beings. She'll buy some anti-aging mascara. Surely they've come up with that by now. What she really needs is an anti-aging mirror. It's not cute, what you're doing, Tessa says. It's not funky or cool or fun. You'll hate it. Helen turns to face her. How do you know? You're talking about yourself. Just because you didn't like working there doesn't mean I won't. Mom, imagine yourself folding the same sweater 100 times a day. Imagine saying, "Welcome to Anthropology," to hostile customers who only want to be left alone. I hardly think they'll be hostile. Tessa waves her hand as though flicking away the black fly of her mother's ignorance. You've never worked retail. You have no idea how rude people can be, or how weird. Helen refrains from answering, "Expect the worst and you'll get it." She applies a thin coat of coral-colored lipstick. "Too yellow for your complexion," Tessa says. She is the beauty editor at an online magazine. She makes pronouncements like this with some regularity. "You gave it to me." "I know, but it's too yellow for your complexion. Throw it out. I'll get you some more red tones." Helen looks at the tube. "I don't want to throw it out. I'll donate it somewhere." "Mom, Mom, it's used." "Well, then I'll give it to Grandma." Helen regards herself in the mirror. She sees that Tessa is right about the color of the lipstick on her. She wipes it off and puts on a pinkish shade. Then she walks to the front hall closet to get her coat. "This is going to be a complete waste of your time," Tessa says. One eyebrow is arched and her head is tilted in the "I can't wait to say I told you so" position. The operative word being "your." "What?" "It's my time. I can waste it if I want to. And anyway, it won't be a waste. I need a change of pace." Tessa puts on her coat. She does not button it, and Helen does not tell her to. As she is frequently reminded, her daughter is 27 years old. Still, it's November and cold outside, an insinuating dampness in the air. Tessa does wrap her muffler securely around her throat, Helen is happy to see. "You aren't going to listen to me no matter what I say," Tessa says. "You're going to go down there and apply, and they'll hire you because they're desperate, and then you'll see how disgusting it is to work with spoiled brats, and then you'll quit." "Well," Helen says, "it will be something to do, won't it? Do you want to ride back downtown?" Tessa wordlessly exits the house, letting the storm door fall shut instead of holding it open for her mother, who is close behind her. Helen figures the whole way downtown Tessa will continue to punish her, and she considers for a moment telling her daughter to take the L home. But she won't. It's her daughter. She wonders how many times in her life she's told herself that. There is silence until they are out of Oak Park and onto the Eisenhower. And then Helen looks over at Tessa, who is pointedly staring straight ahead. "Who's spoiled?" she asks, and is gratified to see Tessa smile, then reach over and turn on the CD player. It's over. Tessa selects Nicole Atkins' Neptune City and turns the volume up. Helen boosts the volume a bit more. On music, she and her daughter agree completely. They've even gone to concerts together, and Tessa never seems to be embarrassed by the fact that she is there with her mother. Oftentimes, they will both hear something in a song and turn to smile at each other like girlfriends. They feel music in the same way. It is a source of pride for Helen. Helen's best friend, Midge, has a daughter Tessa's age, and Amanda plays music that Midge says makes her feel like shooting herself. twice. But Tessa custom mixes a CD for her mother every Christmas, selecting her own favorite songs of the moment, and it is always Helen's favorite gift. Helen's husband, Dan, died suddenly 11 months and 3 days ago, dropping his coffee cup and sliding almost noiselessly out of his kitchen chair and onto the floor. Helen, who'd been standing at the sink, still feels guilty about yelling at him for breaking his cup before she turned to see him sprawled on his back, his eyes wide open and startled looking. She believes the last thing Dan felt was surprise, and to her way of thinking, it wasn't a bad way to go. The bad part is he left her here without him, ignorant of, everything. People used to accuse her of being overly dependent on Dan, and it was true. "You give away your power," one friend told Helen. "You infantilize yourself." On that occasion, Helen looked down at her salad plate as though acknowledging culpability and feeling bad about it. But what she was thinking was, "Oh, shut up. It feels good to infantilize myself. You ought to try it. Might take an edge off." On that awful day when Helen realized her husband was dead, it nonetheless occurred to her to ask him what to do about the fact that he had just died. She had called the paramedics. She had tried CPR. Now what should she do? When it came to her, slowly at first, then in a breath-snatching rush of feeling, that she could not ask him this or any other thing ever again, Helen ran to the bathroom to vomit. Then she ran back to kneel beside Dan and called his name over and over again. And then she called Tessa to ask her what to do.